Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for January 29th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, dealing with parasites in the absence of sex, the advent of quantum machines, and we read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about running barefoot from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
In evolutionary terms, lack of sexual reproduction is typically a dead end for animals, resulting in extinction. That's because their enemies, including parasites, would evolve faster than their asexual, genetically identical counterparts and so outcompete them. Despite this, tiny freshwater invertebrates called deloid rotifers haven't had sex for millions of years. And still, even though people have been observing the rotifers for three centuries, no one has ever recorded seeing either a male rotifer or any meiotic eggs that would indicate a sexual partner. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Chris Wilson and Paul Sherman report how the rotifers may have been able to last so long without sex. When water is scarce, the deloid rotifers dry up and blow away, killing or leaving any parasites behind. I spoke with Wilson from Cornell University in New York.
The hypothesis we tested is that rather than co-evolving with their parasites and pathogens genetically, these genetically identical invertebrates have managed to escape them in space and time through losing all the water in their bodies, entering a complete state of desiccation that's called anhydrobiosis, and then blowing away on the wind as little particles smaller than dust to pristine new habitats where the parasites have not yet colonized. And in this way, they're effectively playing a never-ending game of hide-and-seek with their parasites, never staying long enough in the same place that they can all be wiped out by one that has cracked their genetic code.
Where does the deloid rotifer live?
The more appropriate question might be, where doesn't the deloid rotifer live? They're extremely versatile as far as freshwater habitats go, and because of their tiny body size, remember these animals are less than half a millimeter in length, they can inhabit and reproduce in microhabitats as small as a film on a patch of moss or in a puddle of rainwater, not to mention any freshwater streams, lakes, and so on. And so they live in these constantly fluctuating freshwater habitats that are always drying out and potentially forming dust particles that can then blow and colonize new habitats. They're amongst the most highly dispersive of all animals in their lifestyles. And so the conditions we've represented in this experiment, we think fairly closely approximate what the deloids would be experiencing in nature.
In your team's experiments, how long do the deloid rotifers need to remain dried up to kill off the pathogens?
Well, in our experiments, we infected almost 100 populations of deloid rotifers and dried them for various amounts of time, rehydrating them after 1 week, 2 weeks, and so on to see whether the parasite was still present. Turned out that after 1 week or 2 weeks, the parasites just bounced right back along with the rotifers and resumed their destruction of these genetically identical populations. But after 3 weeks, over 60% of the populations had completely lost the parasites, and the rotifers went on to reproduce in those populations relatively normally. And after 4 and 5 weeks of desiccation, the results were even more dramatic. We had a 90% reduction in the rates of parasitism after 5 weeks of desiccation, and the rotifers enjoyed a pretty much normal growth period.
And these parasites are fungi?
Yes, a whole range of really nasty little soil microfungi that reproduce with tiny little infectious spores that the rotifers filter into their mouths and swallow, whereon they get lodged in the throat, germinate, and produce little digestive cells that eat the rotifer from the inside out and eventually produce more spores at the water surface to infect all the rotifers, sisters, mothers, cousins, and so on.
Now, I can see why the fungus itself might not be able to survive this desiccation. What about the spores, though? Can they survive the drying up and blowing away, too?
This result was somewhat surprising for us, since the parasite appears to have all the advantages in this system. The parasite can produce thousands of spores, whereas there may be only a few hundred rotifers, and these spores are produced in little trees at the water's surface that look maybe a little bit like dandelion clocks. So you'd expect them to be able to blow around very widely and infect a broad range of habitats in the locality. But it turns out that actually the little spores are not resistant to desiccation at all. Even in the shortest periods of desiccation, we couldn't get the spores themselves to reinfect the rehydrated populations. It turns out it's the feeding cells inside the rotifers that are doing the surviving, and they're really not that good at it. They seem somewhat fragile, and so long periods of desiccation or blowing around really seem to break them up and prevent them from regenerating after the water returns to the habitat.
So when the Deloid rotifer's habitat dries up, then it just dries up too and can blow away to a new habitat.
Yes, that's correct.
And if this happens when its population is infected with this fungal pathogen, the fungus can't survive being dried up as long, and even if it does, might be blown away somewhere else from the Deloid rotifers.
That's correct. So we found actually that after 3 weeks, just looking at individual plates, the Deloids were 4 times as good at surviving desiccation as the parasites. And after 4 and 5 weeks, it was a tenfold difference in the survival of the rotifer over the parasite. And in the wind condition, when we blew around the parasites and the rotifers to see whether the parasite could accompany the rotifers escaped without the parasites in the majority of cases. So even though the parasite has some limited capacity for dispersal, it doesn't seem to be doing so at the same rate as the rotifers.
Does the Deloid rotifer somehow sense its fungal infection and dry itself up, even when water is available?
This is an interesting speculation that we've been using over in the lab. Anhydrobiosis, the process of surviving desiccation, is essentially passive. When water is removed from the habitat, the Deloid can protect itself from the complete loss of the cellular water. To the extent that it has a choice, it could perhaps behaviorally move to an edge of a water body or an area of higher concentration of solutes, which would indicate that desiccation is more likely to happen. So perhaps they have some control over the positioning. Whether or not an infected rotifer can adjust its behavior in that way, we're still investigating. It's one of the things we're curious about.
Now, is this strategy enough of drying up and blowing away to explain the Deloid rotifers and how they've managed to survive even without the evolutionary advantages of sexual reproduction?
This depends somewhat on your views of the evolution of sex itself. There are a variety of hypotheses that explain how sexual reproduction may have been maintained despite its huge inefficiency relative to asexual reproduction. Our work focuses on one of the leading hypotheses, which invokes co-evolving parasites and pathogens as the driving force behind the need for genetic variation. Under that hypothesis, our work and the theory behind it would provide the foundation of a fairly satisfying solution to the Deloid exception. However, Deloids have lots of other unusual characteristics at the genetic level, for instance, and perhaps some of those might be compatible with other views of sex. But as far as the conjecture that sex is maintained by parasites goes, the Deloid rotifers may well have found their way around that particular problem.
How many species of Deloid rotifers are there?
There are over 450 species that have been described. There's an awful lot of cryptic diversity in this group because it's very difficult when something reproduces asexually to distinguish among all the essentially similar, very similar clones.
So it's some other method of diversification, speciation, other than through sexual reproduction.
Yes, it turns out that actually sexual reproduction may not be as important as has previously been thought in the process of speciation, because even though these organisms are completely asexual, they still evolve into fairly distinct niches and show the characteristics we would expect to find of genetically isolated sexual species. And this in itself is an interesting evolutionary observation, as it suggests that natural selection can maintain morphologically distinguished species even without genetic isolation through sex.
Chris Wilson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Chris Wilson of Cornell University is lead author of a paper on how anciently asexual Deloid rotifers escape lethal fungal parasites by drying up and blowing away. If a machine's movement obeyed the weird rules of quantum mechanics,
it could only absorb energy in discrete quanta, and it could literally be in two places at the same time.
Science's Adrian Cho reports in this week's issue on the advent of quantum machines, tiny, vibrating devices that make the slightest possible movement.
Physicists are trying to make tiny little machines whose movement obeys the weird rules of quantum mechanics. They haven't quite gotten there yet, but their first goal is to make a machine that literally makes the smallest possible movement allowable by quantum mechanics. And there are a number of groups who've just about reached it, and according to a number of researchers, there's in fact one group that seems to have done the trick. And that's the first step towards making these little mechanical devices that do much stranger things.
Who is working on these quantum machines and why?
So there are a number of different groups working on this. This is an effort that's been going on for a decade or more. And about 7 years ago, it appeared that researchers were just about there. They had just about reached this state of minimal motion called the ground state. But it turned out to be harder to do than they had thought. And at the time, there were mostly condensed matter physicists working on this with tiny little beams of semiconductor, and there were maybe a half a dozen groups pushing at this. Now the field has gotten quite a bit more diverse, and there are a number of groups working on optical methods to achieve this, and they've brought in all the tools from quantum optics, and people working on gravity wave detectors are pushing in this direction. So the field has actually gotten much more diverse.
And what will quantum machines be useful for?
Well, that's a good question. Nobody's quite sure yet. These little machines are machines in a kind of very abstract sense. You know, they're really tiny little beams, like diving boards, perhaps, made out of semiconductors that vibrate up and down or side to side. Others are little rings of glass that light can circulate through that expand and contract radially. So they're machines in the sense that they move, but the first goal has, of course, been to reach this ground state of motion where all but the last little half quantum of energy, which can never come out, has been sucked away, and you see this minimal so-called zero-point motion. But once that's been achieved, the hope is that you can make stranger states of motion, for instance, where one of these tiny little vibrating beams is vibrating around two different positions at the same time. And once you can do that, it's pretty much up to researchers' imaginations what you might try with this. Some obvious things are that a little vibrating beam in its ground state would be a very sensitive force detector, perhaps the most sensitive force detector that you can come up with. So an immediate use for this might be some sort of very delicate force probes for basic research. Beyond that, since there's so much interest in using light to manipulate these tiny little vibrating machines, it's possible that they'll become elements in optical experiments. So now physicists need elements called nonlinear optical elements that will do things like take in a photon of one higher energy and split it into two photons of lower energy. And that's currently done by shooting light through certain crystals. There's a problem with that in that the crystals tend to soak up a lot of the light, so they're not particularly efficient. And so one hope is that these little quantum machines will actually work as nonlinear optical elements so that you can do some of the same things that you do with these crystals, but with much smaller losses. Beyond that, it seems probable that once physicists can control motion in this quantum mechanical way, that they'll start to blend these tiny little devices in with electronic devices and optical devices in a way that they could become, you know, very complicated, where they all work together. So, for instance, one could imagine using one of these tiny little vibrating devices to, say, take signals that are conveyed in the quantum states of optical photons and convert them into microwaves or into electrical signals and to sort of pull all these together in one technology. There are already proposals, for instance, to use these tiny little vibrating beams in experiments that would make a quantum connection between their motion and the internal states of individual atoms.
And how close are physicists to this goal in the published literature?
Well, so they're pretty close. In the last 6 months, about four teams have gotten within a few dozen quanta of reaching this ground state, this state of minimal energy. Three of them have used optical techniques, and this is quite clever. Physicists have actually developed a technique whereby they can shine light on a little vibrating object and extract energy from it. And the basic idea is that the vibrating element makes one end of a so-called optical cavity. If you will, it's sort of an organ pipe for light, right? So it's two mirrors that light waves can bounce between in much the same way that sound waves resonate in an organ pipe. And the idea is that one of these mirrors is on your little vibrating widget, and if you tune the light that you're shining into this thing, down just a little bit off the frequency that this cavity would like to resonate at, if you tune it down just a little bit, it can pick up energy from this vibrating widget and actually make the widget lose energy. And so three different groups have tried that basic optical technique and have gotten within a few dozen quanta of the ground state. And there was a fourth group that did a similar technique using microwaves and a smaller resonator, smaller oscillating beam, and they actually got to within 4 quanta. So there are a number of groups right on the doorstep.
So there's another team out there, though, that has actually achieved this ground state?
That appears to be the case. The results aren't published yet, but a number of researchers who've seen the paper say that the paper is describing the work, say that it seems to be pretty convincing. And this is work by Andrew Cleland and John Martinez and their colleagues at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
Are they using the same kind of approach?
So they actually are using a somewhat more old-fashioned approach where they have a little beam that they've etched out of a material that can vibrate, and they put it in a liquid helium refrigerator and make it as cold as possible and just passively draw the energy out of it that way, and they're trying to draw all the energy out of it and get it down to its ground state of motion. But they have some tricks because that way proved difficult a number of years ago, and so they've improved on this sort of basic straightforward approach. And the real key to their work is that they use a widget called a phase qubit to actually read out the motion of this little vibrating beam. 7 years ago, researchers were basically trying to do this by putting a voltage between the vibrating beam and a nearby electrode, and that voltage would vary as the beam moved, and they were trying to use that to track the motion of the beam. To get to the ground state of motion, you have to drive the frequency of the motion up as high as you possibly can. And the problem is, when they would drive the frequency up, the amount of motion actually got smaller and smaller, so they had a hard time tracking this. So Cleland and Martinez have used this qubit to overcome this. Essentially, what happens is that the qubit itself is an electronic system, and it's a quantum system with a couple of states, a ground state and a more energetic state. And basically what they can do is that they can feed one quantum of energy into this electronic phase qubit and then make it talk to the moving beam and then shuffle that quantum of energy over to the moving beam. So once they can show they can do that, they can just run the whole process backwards and extract energy one quantum at a time out of the beam. And essentially what they were able to show is that they'd gotten the beam so cold that there were no quanta of energy to take out at all. It was simply in its ground state. So other researchers seem to think that they've shown this, that they can actually get a beam to make the slightest motion possible.
Adrian Cho, thank you very much.
Well, thanks very much, Rob.
Science's Adrian Cho on the advent of quantum machines, tiny vibrating devices that make the slightest possible movement. Now, David Graham, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about running barefoot. Not something I'd want to do on my street.
Well, Rob, it's something that humans have been doing for 2 million years. In fact, running shoes have only been around for about 100 years, and they've only really became popular in the 1970s. And so in this study, researchers were wondering, you know, if we've been running that long on bare feet, is it better to run on bare feet? Is it possible that running with shoes on is actually hurting our bodies?
I would assume that the answer is yes, although the glass and other things that are on my street, I'm not really sure I would want to have my bare feet exposed to.
That's true. There are definitely some advantages to running shoes like the ones you just mentioned. But in this study, researchers found that there's a lot of disadvantages as well. They looked at about 200 people, both from the U.S. and Kenya, which is famous for producing a lot of long-distance runners. And they looked at people who had worn running shoes all their life, who had never worn shoes at all, and people in between. And they had them run on treadmills and things like that. And they measured how much impact the running was having on their feet and on the rest of their body. And the first interesting thing that they noticed was that people that wore shoes, when they ran, they tended to land on the heel of their foot, whereas barefoot runners tended to land on the ball of their foot. So that was sort of an interesting finding. But the real interesting finding came when they looked at what the impact of these two different running styles had on the body. And what they found is that the people without shoes on, they were seeing a lot more flex in the foot, in the arch of the foot, in the ankle and the knee, and even in the calf muscle. So the body was absorbing a lot more of the impact of the running, which is a good thing because you don't want all that impact focused on one place, versus the people with shoes on, they were experiencing a lot more shock to their body, up to 4 times more shock than the people that were running barefoot.
So the heel-toe strategy of running around with shoes on is not so good.
Well, that's what the study seems to indicate.
So what's the solution? Is it to run differently?
Well, I mean, on the face of it, the solution is for all of us to run barefoot. But as you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of glass on the ground and other things that would make that a bad idea, at least in urban environments. Even the research team isn't advocating barefoot running because of that reason, and because it's also just one study. But the author of the study is actually a runner himself and has, since conducting the study, has begun to start running barefoot. So that may tell you something. But he says, you know, if people are interested in running barefoot, they shouldn't just go cold turkey with their running shoes. They should gradually transition to make sure that their bodies adjust properly.
Okay, so what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from feet to feathers, this next story is about whether dinosaurs had feathers, and if so, what color they were. And Rob, believe it or not, despite all of our scientific advances, we still don't know what color dinosaurs were. All these movies you see like Jurassic Park, that's just the CGI artist's imagination. And actually, people that study dinosaurs have said, we'll never know what color dinosaurs were. But some of them are actually changing their tune now that this new study has come out.
Some new evidence then.
Exactly. This study looks at fossilized dinosaurs and looks specifically at organelles, which are these tiny compartments in a cell, fossilized organelles called melanosomes. And melanosomes contain melanin. And you may know that melanin is responsible for giving us our skin color and also tanning and things like that. Well, it's also responsible for color in general. And researchers, if they do electron microscopy on these melanin compounds, these group of pigment compounds, even though the compounds themselves are not colored, if you look closely enough at them, the compounds have different structures depending on what their color is. So even though it looks black and white under a scanning electron microscope, you can say, hey, this particular tissue or this particular feather in this case must have been white, or it must have been gray or even orange.
So which particular dinosaur are we talking about here, and what color was it?
Well, Rob, for this study, they looked at two creatures. One was a Cretaceous bird called Confucius ornis. And this was a 125-million-year-old bird, and the researchers detected two types of melanosomes in its fossilized feathers, one which gave rise to a black-gray color, and another one that gave rise to a reddish-brown color. And you can see a reconstruction of what this ancient bird looked like on the site. We have a nice slideshow that has this and pictures of this dinosaur, which was called Cynosauropteryx. And this is a dinosaur that also lived in the Cretaceous period. And the researchers found that the structures of its pigment compounds indicated that it had reddish brown stripes covering the tail, and that there was areas of it that were completely missing these melanosomes, which indicates that these areas of the animal were white.
And this is convincing scientists not only of the color, but that at least for one particular dinosaur, it had feathers?
Right. And the reason the scientists say that is because all of this material they're studying would be much better preserved if it was part of a feathers. If it was part of the skin, chances are it would have decayed very quickly, would not have been fossilized well. So they're just saying just the very fact that these melanosomes are preserved indicates that they must have been part of a structure like a feather.
What are other researchers saying about this?
Well, first of all, researchers think it's really cool that we can actually perhaps get a sense for what dinosaurs look like. But this whole idea of whether dinosaurs had feathers or not is still very contentious. It's been one of the most contentious topics in dinosaur science. So the people that fall down on the side that dinosaurs never had feathers aren't convinced by this study. They're saying that perhaps the melanosomes actually didn't come from the dinosaur at all. Maybe they were just bacteria that somehow were part of the fossil, and that's what the researchers are looking at. So that particular debate rages on, but at least for now, we've got some nice, colorful pictures of dinosaurs that are more accurate than they've ever been before.
Okay, so last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from tiny pigments to tiny particles, this last story is about tiny particles crashing together and forming black holes.
This is some sort of concern about the Large Hadron Collider?
Well, yes, tangentially, the Large Hadron Collider is this giant multi-billion dollar physics experiment happening in Switzerland where researchers are zooming particles through these tunnels at enormous speeds and enormous energies and crashing them into each other, hoping to produce new particles and potentially even something called the God particle, which would explain why objects have mass. But one concern about smashing these particles together at such high energy is that it could create black holes. And there's actually even been groups that have petitioned to shut down the LHC because they say it's going to create a black hole that's going to swallow the world. Now, physicists say that's impossible, that the LHC could create a black hole that's going to swallow the world. But it is theoretically possible that it could create these tiny black holes. But nobody had actually shown that this could actually happen. And that's what this new study is about. Can smashing these tiny particles together actually create a black hole?
So some kind of computer simulation. The LHC isn't up to speed yet.
Exactly. And this all has to do with a theory that Einstein had, which is basically if you put too much mass or too much energy into an extremely small volume, you'll create a black hole because essentially putting too much mass and energy into this very small space warps space-time, and space-time can be warped so much that nothing, not even light, can escape, and essentially you have a black hole. But again, researchers have actually never run a simulation to show that this could actually happen, and that's what they did in this study. So what researchers did was they took hundreds of computers, and they modeled these two tiny particles. They had them smash into each other at tremendous energies, and they observed, doing a bunch of very complicated physics equations, that indeed smashing these two particles together would create a very small black hole.
Is the LHC capable of producing that much energy and smashing these things together that fast?
Well, what the researchers say is that the LHC would need to produce a quintillion times more energy than it does right now to even have the prospect of something like this happening.
A quintillion? How many zeros is that?
That's a lot, Rob. It's actually 10 to the 18th as much power that the LHC will produce when it maxes out. Although there is one possibility, Rob, there is a theory that's been going around actually in physics for a long time, that there are extra dimensions of space that we can't see. And if these extra dimensions actually exist, then they could potentially significantly lower the amount of energy needed to create a black hole by smashing two particles together. But physicists say even if that happened, even if all this stuff came to pass, these black holes that would be produced by the LHC would first of all be extremely tiny, and second of all, they would harmlessly decay almost immediately, so they wouldn't pose a threat to anything.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, while we're still on the astronomy kick, we've got a story about how heavyweight stars are born just like our sun, and also a story about altruism in chimpanzees. And on Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about the end of the line for Mars's Spirit rover. It's become stuck in the sand, and it looks like it's the end of the mission, although scientists say it may still have a few more experiments left in it. And there's also a story about Bill Gates getting into the geoengineering game. Geoengineering is this whole idea that we can somehow combat global warming by doing various things like launching mirrors into space to block the sun or seeding the ocean with iron to increase the uptake of carbon dioxide. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. Finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is our letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, we start with a letter in response to the October 30th News of the Week story by Udijit Bhattacharjee, titled, Study Finds Science Pipeline Strong, But Losing Top Students. In the January 1st issue, Guru Prasad Madhavan from the National Academy of Sciences here in Washington, D.C., and Barbara Ann Oakley from Oakland University in Minnesota write in, asking, why not let these talented, scientifically trained human catalysts shift gears and move into areas such as public policy, legislation, law, finance, economics, public relations, and yes, even entertainment, that seemingly silly place where ideas and visions are formed?
The authors continue, it would help to have scientifically trained policymakers and legislators who truly understand the scientific and technologic issues they are voting on, with enough clout to get others on board. It would also help to have management consultants and financial analysts who avoid entrenched mindsets and realize that some visionary business approaches are de facto Ponzi schemes.
The authors conclude, a protectionist attitude that expects the best students to stay within their formative disciplines has pernicious consequences. Top students in science and engineering form a gift to society and to the scientific enterprise when they fly forth to pollinate areas of vital importance to the public discourse. Cross-disciplinary ambassadors should be encouraged, not discouraged, if we are to build a bright, new, sustainable future.
Our next letter comes in response to the January 1st editorial, Promoting Scientific Standards, by Science's editor-in-chief, Bruce Alberts. In that editorial, Alberts discusses two authorship issues. First, that new procedures at Science Magazine will discourage what are called honorary authorships, and that each author will be required to identify his or her contribution to the research. Second, that science will require that the senior author for each laboratory or group confirm that he or she has personally reviewed the original data generated by that unit, ascertaining that the data selected for publication in specific figures and tables have been appropriately presented.
Zen Falks of the University of Texas Pan American writes in response to say that the new science policies described by Alberts do not follow the Vancouver Guidelines, also known as the International Committee Medical Journal Editors Guidelines on Authorship, and that, in turn, writes Falks, suggests that we need a new model for assigning credit to scientific projects. Falks's suggestion, that films might provide that model. Falks writes, movie productions, like large scientific projects, represent the collaborative efforts of large teams, often working semi-independently of each other. The credits spell out who did what, director, cinematographer, screenwriter, and so on. There is no pretense that everyone who contributed to the film is an author of the film.
Falks concludes, honorary authorships are often given to principal investigators who provide resources, but minimal scientific input. Such investigators are analogous to film producers, who often set up financing and handle administration. It is appropriate that this important work receives due credit, but that credit should not imply involvement in the creative process. Such contributions would probably not be recognized if the film industry were using, as science still does, the blunt instrument of authorship.
You can read the whole letter in this week's issue. Our final letter is also in this week's issue. Marion Nessel from New York University writes in to respond to the December 18th Random Samples article, Science for the Fair Sex, which highlights the Girls' Night Out series at the New York Academy of Sciences. The series features women scientists speaking on topics close to women and the people who love them. The Random Samples article then lists out the talks, one on lust, romance, and attachment, one on nutrition and diet, one on our intimate connections to trees, and finally, one titled Survival of the Prettiest, Evolution, Beauty, and Human Happiness. The Random Samples article concludes, guest girls are interested in science only if you can find a link to food, love, or makeup.
Nessel writes, as a longtime reader of science and the invited food speaker to the New York Academy of Sciences series Girls' Night Out, I take exception to the idea that the choice of topics condescends to women. When I see the statement, guest girls are interested in science only if you can find a link to food, love, or makeup, I see the attitude, all too familiar to those of us whose work crosses into social science, that nothing but cell biology and genetics constitute real science. The statement suggests that work dealing with quotidian matters such as food, love, or even makeup cannot possibly be scientifically rigorous or interesting.
I would argue instead, Nessel continues, that rigorous scientific thinking thoroughly informs my research on the influence of politics on agricultural production and consumption, particularly with respect to obesity and food safety. My lecture to the girls on 16 February will be much the same as the talks I give to mixed-gender audiences of researchers, university professors, health professionals, government officials, and business leaders. I am curious to know whether social scientists are as tired as I am of colleagues characterizing our work as insufficiently scientific to be taken seriously.
You can find the letter in this week's issue of Science. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor of Science Magazine. And that wraps up the January 29th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.